Hello and welcome. This is Pastor Ken Ortiz, and I want to thank you for joining me on my ongoing podcast called What's the World Coming To? And this week I want to focus on a question that many people are asking, why are businesses going woke? The reality is that when we're watching TV, we see all of these commercials, and I don't know if you can miss it, but there seems to be a very open portrayal of people who are transsexual, who are homosexual, all these kind of things that you would think would cause brand problems, as we saw with Disney and also with Budweiser most recently. And we have to ask the obvious question, are these people stupid? Don't they realize that they're alienating their audience and their basically customers by promoting lifestyles that are so contrary to what is traditionally accepted and basically viewed as being morally acceptable? And for Christians, are basically perverted and abominable. Well, you just wonder, are they that isolated? Are they that out of touch? And the answer is yes and no. So what I'm going to try to do is explain to you what really is the motivation behind taking these kind of risks. Like Budweiser, their Bud Light brand may never survive. Keep in mind, that's their highest grossing product. And now it's become something that people don't even want to be seen holding a Bud Light can because it has such a negative view. So you realize that this may not be something that they're able to recover from. They may have to go through an entire rebranding. But the reality is, which won't that be that hard for them? They just disguise themselves behind other brands anyway already. But the whole point is that they spent decades building this very popular beer brand, and now they've lost billions of dollars and millions of customers because of the insensitivity of creating this Dylan Mulvaney face on this guy pretending to be a girl on the cover of or the front of the can. So anyway, but I want to begin with a really quick disclaimer too, because I am not an economist, and although I don't have a great regard for economists, I know they understand economic theory and they understand a lot about how to read spreadsheets and all of the rest. But as far as prognosticators or being able to predict accurately what's coming, they get it wrong as much and as often as you and I get it wrong. And so in economics, as if you're talking about an accountant doing bookkeeping or things of that nature, that's a discipline and it's very good. But as far as prognosticating, looking into the future, many of them are subject to the same biases and weaknesses that you and I have. I think there's one guy on CNN, which may explain why their ratings are so bad, who is one of their financial advisors, and this guy has got it wrong on every single thing. I mean, he's telling people to buy stocks, and the next day they crash, and this has happened repeatedly, and he's one of those, of course, that said that inflation was transitory and we shouldn't worry about it, and you begin to realize that many of these people who are part of the media, what we call the legacy media, are people who basically are just simply parroting the company line, that they don't answer to their audiences, but they answer to powers that are above them, which is not something new. There, we often talk about freedom of the press, and we operate under the assumption that there was a time when newspapers were honest and just told the story the way it was meant to be told. In fact, historically, newspapers have always had a political bias. The difference is people understood the bias, and if you wanted to get two sides of the story, you could read two different newspapers. But the problem is today we have this fantasy that people who are anchors on TV in particular are just giving us the facts, just the facts, man. When in fact we are being served either by adding something to or taking something away. In fact, many of the deceptive things that are presented are the result of leaving out vital details. And that's part of the 13-second soundbite that we are subject to in this day and age, where you don't hear serious discussions. Most of us are too bored too quickly to sit and listen to a conversation. And that's one of the reasons why I enjoy when I'm overseas listening to some foreign English broadcast, because oftentimes they will bring basically somebody on, there won't be commercial interruptions, and there'll be a lengthy conversation and debate and disagreement, and many times the interviewers, who aren't anchors, they're interviewers, they're really trying to really kind of squeeze out the exact or the correct or the right information, and it really does give you both sides of the argument, but that doesn't happen with our media today. You're going to get one point of view, and so you have to decide which programs you're going to watch if you're going to get your news from programs, or which periodicals or websites you're going to read. Sadly, most people today get their news from things like Twitter. Most people only read the headlines and not the story underneath it. And one of the tricks you find, the headlines are often meant to be very sensational, but when you go through and read the article, when you get down to the third or fourth paragraph, you begin to find that the story is actually saying something completely different than the headline would suggest. And so everything is driven by clicks and by, you know, product endorsements, how many people go to your site, how many people follow your program. It's all about ratings, unless, of course, you're Fox News, and we'll get into that a little bit as well. But my proposition, really, that what I'm saying is that all of us have wondered why so many companies have suddenly become so present, so obvious, and featuring not only people from the LGBTQ community, but also even people of color, that is way out of proportion to their demographic representation of the culture. I mean, when you talk about people who are in the LGBTQ community, you're talking about probably about 1% of the overall population. So it's just a fragment. And also, when we talk about people of color, they make up between, maybe if you include Hispanics and people of Asian Indian descent and so forth and so on, that they may make up 15% of the overall population. Most people in America are white Anglo-Saxon, either Catholic or Protestant or none. But nonetheless, if you want to reach the broadest number of people, you'd think they would appeal to people who look like us. In fact, part of the thing that I've noticed is that the number of people who are overweight featured in commercials also indicates the common sense that if you want to communicate with people who see themselves in the commercials and the presentation of the programs, you're going to pick somebody that looks like them. And unfortunately, obesity is the major health problem in America today. It's really the force that lies behind heart disease and cancer and many other ailments. And basically, they understand that they need to feature people who look like us, especially when they're trying to sell us medications and drugs that are probably more dangerous than obesity. But nonetheless, why are they doing this? What's behind this? It doesn't make a lot of sense to the ordinary person. And that's what I'm going to try to explain to you. And I want to begin really with the United Nations. And you have to go back quite a few years, but you have to begin by understanding what the United Nations' ultimate goal was. And more importantly, what was the goal behind those who helped formalize and formulate the United Nations? I mean, part of it grew out of a weariness of war. Part of it grew out of the failure of the League of Nations, which was the first effort. It failed in part because the United States wasn't willing to be a player. We wanted to isolate from the problems of the world. After World War II, it was decided that the United States had to become actively engaged in any kind of international organization. And at that time, the United States was the most powerful country in the world, both geopolitically and geoeconomically, and even militarily. I mean, we were the most powerful force on the planet, followed closely, but not too closely, by the Soviet Union. And so they formed this organization, which was essentially controlled by five nations, basically included the United States and Russia and China, Great Britain and France. Basically, we had the larger part of that group. But what was interesting is they gave power or authority to each of those members to veto anything that would be passed out of what was called the General Assembly. Now, there were five members of that that governing group, and then there was another five seats that were held by nations that were drawn really from 10 other nations, and there was five different international regions, and so there was the five basic nations, the United States, Russia, China, France, and Britain, and then you add China, and then you added to it the five representatives from different parts, from Asia, from Europe, from Africa, and so forth, so that this group actually had 10 members who were sitting there. And I just say it's an interesting comparison, because the one world government we find in the book of Revelation and in Daniel has 10 representative groups. It says kingdoms, which is a really broad and vast term, that basically these are people who have powerful authority, kind of kingly authority. So the last one world government at the end is a confederation of states that eventually becomes powerfully controlled by one single individual. And interestingly, three of the members of those 10 kingdoms are overtaken by that individual. And I might suggest that they would be the United States and the European Union and probably European Union and probably one other group of powerful groups, maybe like our friendly Asian partners. But essentially, they take control of this organization. He takes control of this organization and leads it to the diabolical global empire that he seeks to establish. But when I go back to the forming of the United Nations, the world really came down to kind of a bipolar world power structure. You had the United States and the Soviet Union, which were the most powerful entities on the planet. They soon both had nuclear capacity, which made them threatening to everybody else. And both of them wanted their system to be the center of the global system. But yet the survival of both became the mission of basically both of them, because they really could counter each other because of nuclear power. But the problem, the tension was their systems of economics and government were diametrically opposed. And in the end, they recognized, or they believed, that only one or the other could succeed. Now, when you look at the Reagan era, what Reagan managed to do was simply to outspend the Soviets. He pushed them, especially when he expanded our military might and our nuclear force. Russia tried to catch up, but they weren't able to catch up. They didn't have the material economic resources. Their economy was beginning to implode. That they had been basically sucking off the other countries that they had taken over during World War II in Eastern Europe. And those country systems were beginning to break down, because a socialist economic system only has one real effective tool, and that's to provide people with equality of poverty. And believe me, as somebody who's made over 150 trips to Russia, I will tell you that that's exactly what was the result of the years of Soviet socialism. Now, it's always funny to me, because the young socialists and communists today, that these young millennials and Zers are growing up so enthusiastic for communist systems and socialist systems, of course, have very little life experience. And in their arrogance, what they say is, well, those systems failed, but we're going to do it better. We're going to do it right this time. And I find that comical, because the one error of the socialist system is that it doesn't accept that man is a sinner. It believes that man is basically good and altruistic in his motivations. And that's simply not true. We are sinners, and we are evil. That's why I tell people many times when they say, why does God allow evil in the world? And my answer is, if he didn't, you wouldn't be here. The fact is, we're all sinners. That means we're all guilty of engaging in evil. Not similar degrees, because we don't have similar elements of freedom. And some of us have a conscience towards God, if not simply a fear of God, a sense of what's right and wrong. But the bottom is that the Soviet Union basically began to dissolve because of the leadership of Ronald Reagan encountering them. He called them the evil empire. They invaded Afghanistan, which became as disastrous as our engagement in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, particularly our hasty withdrawal from that country. And when I first began to go over to Russia after the Soviet Union had dissolved, I saw a country that was in an economic train wreck. I mean, literally, that we used to bring our own food in. We'd take evangelistic teams over, and we'd actually bring large U-Haul boxes. I mean, ones that are 2.5 feet tall by 2 feet wide. And we'd fill them with food goods because we had trouble finding food. It was that terrible. And so during those times, we just began to find that criminality just took off. And ultimately, the reason Putin was supported in coming to power was because lawlessness had become so widespread in the country that people were willing to give up freedom in order to have some kind of safety. And, of course, the question of safety is one that they really have again. But what happened is almost overnight, the United States became the sole superpower. And the world had to deal now with this singular unipolar system that everything revolved around the United States. And during the period where the George H. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush were in power, were president of the United States, this was pretty much the system. And it's interesting because around the same time as when in 1992 that the European Union was formed, and the European Union had one singular ambition, and that was to be, economically at least, a counterbalance to the United States. There is, even to this day, huge resentment in many places in Europe because of the power of the United States to push its own agenda. And oftentimes we force them into doing things that they really don't want to do, like invading Iraq. And keep in mind, at that time, China was not yet considered a worthy competitor. They were just a marketplace where you could get cheap labor. But still, in so many ways, they were way behind the development of Europe and the United States in particular. But during that period, especially beginning with George Herbert Bush, there was this reference over and over to a new world order. And when George Bush, the first, basically, 41, would make that statement, he was talking about the United States crafting this new world order, this new world system. And I really believe he passed that vision on to his son, George W. Bush, who was number 43 in the presidential sequence. But he basically set out to spread the U.S. theory of economics, of industrial capitalism, to the rest of the world. The idea of free markets, about democratic elected leaders, and so forth and so on. Now, you have to keep in mind that most of the world then and now, and even more so today, were not run by democratically elected people. And even if they were, they very quickly seized power and became dictators. And that is pretty much the theme, that even though they were elected, not unlike what we're dealing with in this country right now, that we have people who supposedly were elected to this office, but they began to exercise illegal dictatorial powers through things they call executive orders. But all of this basically, you know, they have an emergency powers like came under COVID, where they could shut down the economy and put people in jail for doing things that they didn't want them to do. But we find that what Herbert Bush came up with this idea of the Iraq coalition, the invasion of Iraq, and he called it the coalition of the willing. And if you dig into the geopolitics of the time, it's rather, rather confusing, because essentially we had been very supportive of Saddam Hussein. We encouraged him in his invasion of Iran and that bloodbath that went on for several years, and really supplied him with weaponry and a number of other things, advisors and so forth. And yet, when he then invaded Iraq, he always claimed that he had been given a green light and that he had been really betrayed by the United States. Whatever the basis of that really was, I mean, I wouldn't put it past Saddam Hussein to lie, but the whole idea was that we were terrified that he would gain an unequal control of the world's oil supply. And so invading somebody who we saw as a friendly regime was something that was viewed as being unacceptable. And so we had Desert Storm, very successful militarily. And maybe the wisest thing we did after that was to withdraw and just wait for, for Iraq to implode on its own. Unfortunately, Saddam didn't go down that easily and continued to hold on to power. But essentially, we wanted to stabilize the world's oil supply, not just our own, because remember, even back then, we were backing away from producing our own fuel and becoming dependent on Middle Eastern fuel. But the simple fact was we wanted to make sure that the overall industrial ability of the world stayed intact by being able to fuel the factories that were producing the goods that all of us were so deeply addicted to. At the same time, the United Nations kind of went through an invigoration because the United Nations was becoming increasingly irrelevant in terms of what was going on in the world. Because, after all, the U.S. and Russia were running the show, and then when Russia fell apart, then it was just the United States, and nobody really took the U.N. that seriously. I mean, they did and said things that may have irritated us, but we still controlled to a very significant degree what took place within the UN. And if they did something we didn't agree with, then we just ignored them. But what Bush 41 did was, by saying he wanted to call together a coalition of the willingly. In other words, he didn't want the United States going in all by themselves. That looked bad. So what he wanted to do is bring other countries to contribute to the invasion to make it look like this was international in its character. Now, we find the same thing that Clinton did, the same thing with Bosnia and our involvement militarily. When you get down to it, it was 90% us. Even under Obama, when we went into Libya, ultimately, the United States provided all of the air power and surveillance and spycraft and all the things that went into that debacle as well. The irony is there was this hubris amongst American statesmen that somehow we could deliver these people from dictators and then install democratically elected people who would seek for the well-being. The problem is these countries, both their leaders and their people, have no concept or necessarily a respect for democracy. Even in countries like Russia, who supposedly elect Putin, basically, Russians I've talked to have told me they respect strong leadership. That's what they respect. Somebody who can take control and keep them safe. And that seems to be true around the world. People just want to live their life. They want to be able to do what they do in safety. And they don't really care that much about how corrupt or how illegal they are, except when they begin to prey on their own citizens, and that's usually when those governments are overthrown. But the idea that they would become democracies is just surely the fantasy of people who have never lived outside of Washington, D.C. for any length of time. So anyway, we find that we begin to see life coming into the UN, and that's when in 1995, as there was a growing mythology being promoted by people like Al Gore, the inventor of the internet, who began to predict that the world was going to come to an end, which was kind of interesting to me because up until 1978, all I heard my whole growing up life was that we were going to go into global cooling and that we were all going to freeze to death in the dark. And then suddenly in 1978, as the global temperatures began to show an uptick, they began to predict that this was going to continue without abatement, and the result was that we were all going to cook to death, that the poles were going to melt, and Manhattan would be underwater, and so forth and so on. So in 1995, with this rising fake myth of global warming and about global famine, which had been pumped by the UN since about 1967, something that has never happened and has really not been the case until recently with our war in Ukraine, and also the threat of pandemics, this fear that somehow there was going to be a pandemic like the one that hit the United States and the world in 1918, the Spanish flu. And interesting little side note regarding the Spanish flu or the swine flu or whatever you want to call it. It really was called the Spanish flu because the Spanish press was the first one to actually identify that there was this epidemic taking place, this weird disease, and that was killing lots of people, but they certainly weren't the first one. One of the greatest exporters of the swine flu, and it may have actually started in the United States, was from Fort Riley, Kansas, where my maternal grandfather was stationed as a medic at the time during World War I, and many of these young men were affected and carried it overseas. My paternal grandfather was a doctor in France, treating the troops, a Marine doctor, and he died of the swine flu, or the Spanish flu as it came to be called. Well, there was this fear because some 60 million people around the world died because of that flu, and they said, we need to be preparing because it's just a matter of time before it comes. And so as a result, they began to talk a lot about what they call these existential crises. Now, existential means simply life-ending, things that will bring to an end life upon earth. And you can only believe in an existential crisis if you don't believe in the Word of God, because the Bible tells us very clearly that the only one who can end life on earth is God Himself. But we find that a clique of very powerful people began to collaborate to save the world. The head of the Chase Manhattan Bank, the David Rockefeller, who was one of the wealthiest and most powerful men of the 20th century, was one of these individuals. He's the one who actually gave the real estate for the United Nations building to be built upon, and he was an avowed globalist. He confessed it. He had worked together and supported many efforts around the world to create a one-world global governance. Now, this has all happened as kind of a strange blending of guilt and greed, you know, that on one hand you have these people who, kind of a new generation of robber barons, people like David Rockefeller or George Soros or Tom Steyer or Bill Gates. I mean, there's a whole list of these individuals who have massive amounts of wealth, who also kind of feel guilty about being so wealthy. Now, they didn't want to ever give it up. But I think as Steve Jobs put it so well, he said, after I made my first $50 million, I realized I would never have any kind of economic need for the rest of my life. And these are people who don't have any concern about being wealthy. To them, their billions is more a way of keeping score in the pecking order of who are the wealthiest, most powerful, and most important people on the planet. And they take great pride in being in the top echelons of that group. Most of them would like to be the richest and the most powerful. Well, they also have no problem with making a profit. So as they enter into their humanitarian efforts to bring peace and safety to the planet Earth, at the same time, they saw a real opportunity in bringing global corporations into open markets without tariffs, without limitations, especially to places like China, Mexico, and India, where there were huge availability to build factories with low-cost employment. So all of the labor from building the factory to running it and producing the goods could be done at such a lower rate that if they could remove these kind of oppositions where simply they had to pay tariffs and taxes and so forth, they could go really begin to increase their wealth and at the same time provide prosperity to people in the third world. Now, there's a certain degree of truth in that. I remember one time doing a missionary outreach in Mexico, and I was talking to some Mexican individuals who worked for American corporations just across the other side of the U.S.-Mexican border, and they said that they really appreciated it because they were being paid $10 an hour. Now, those same jobs in the United States were costing between benefits and wages about $50 an hour. In the United States, they could have that same job without any of the obligations or restrictions for health and safety for only $10 an hour. This is upper management of these companies. So, you know, it did bring a level of prosperity, and they were saying, we don't want these companies to leave. We want them to stay right here. And that really became the impetus, though, when Clinton, you know, pushed through NAFTA, and many other agreements that he was working on, some of which President Trump brought to a close, thank goodness. But basically, they shifted things dramatically. They opened up markets. Manufacturing began to realize very quickly that they could go to Mexico or India or China, save a lot of money, lower their costs, and yet, in turn, bring those products back to the United States without having to pay heavy duties or import taxes, and sell them at the prices that people were basically accustomed to paying. And so groups like Walmart just exploded because they became the primary peddler of these cheap goods, now to be replaced by Amazon. But it was seen in the eyes of many people as being kind of altruistic. You're uplifting the poor nations, you're spreading wealth around the world. But we also realize it had a devastating effect on the U.S. economy. I mean, it created and really led to the development of the Rust Belt. We couldn't produce aluminum or steel or just about any other product nearly as cheaply as they could in other parts of the world, particularly even not only Mexico and India and China, but also in Africa, where so many valuable resources, we call them rare earth materials, are located. And so, essentially, we could begin to mine things that we have available on our own continent, in our own country. We could mine them much cheaper by using close to slave labor in Africa, which is one of my real issues with electric vehicles. Their batteries require cobalt and other things that are really harvested by slaves, if you will, in India. The same way, if you've ever seen the movie Blood Diamonds, which is really something that's very informative, it's the same thing that's going on with the harvesting or the mining of cobalt, where children are being used to break rocks by hand in order to extract the cobalt so that we can have electric vehicles and solar panels and all of the rest. I think that environmentalists really don't really care about poverty in the world. They think they're virtue signaling by buying an electric vehicle, when in fact they're contributing to the oppression of the world's poor in ways that can't even begin to be calculated. It's one of the worst slaveries and genocides going on in the world today. By the way, people talk about slavery. Slavery is well supported around the world today, but they do it in a very simple way. What you do is you put people into a community where the company owns the community. They own the food, the stores, the transportation. People go work in their factories, their mines, their plantations, and then they have to go and buy all of their support from the company, which ends up taking all of their money back. So in the end, the people are enslaved because they have to go work in order to make money to buy foods to survive. And the only way, basically, the money goes from the pocket of the company back into the company's pocket. And this is something you find all over the world, especially in Africa and places like India. Well, let me shift a little bit. The global feeling at that time was that we Americans have been too wealthy for too long and we should share the wealth to be more equitable. And this was certainly the conversation in the Office of the United Nations, which are basically filled with a bunch of criminals who are using their positions to enrich themselves without little concern or care for their countrymen back in their home countries. They believe that it's their right to live as rajas. But we find that in the United States that even farming began to suffer as foods were being imported from around the world without many of the safety concerns that we have in this country, and were being sold at a much lower rate than they could be produced here in this country. The only reason the United States has been able to keep pace with that is because we are technologically so much more advanced that many of the farming jobs which, of course, the illegal aliens are supposed to be filling and were in the past, are being replaced by machinery that does the work for it. I mean, it's amazing when you look at equipment that harvests tomatoes and olives and a whole score of different things that are just machines that they run through the fields. It's fascinating when you go through California, you may see these square trees. Essentially, they're more rectangles than squares, but they're these tall square trees, and they're olive trees, and they are harvested by machine. They are grown and pruned to grow like that so these machines can go through the fields and harvest the olives. It's really quite amazing. I didn't think anything like that would ever be possible. But bottom line is, Wall Street prospered, but Main Street suffered. The U.S. economy made an amazing shift. We went from being about manufacturing and production to investing and money management. Instead of being captains of industry, men like Henry Ford, they'd be replaced by financial gurus like Warren Buffett. Ford made cars, trucks, and tractors. Buffett simply makes money. And I'm not saying there's anything essentially wrong with that. In fact, you may be involved with Berkshire and investing with him, for all I know. But the whole point is this is a major shift. We don't create many products in the country anymore, and we're trying to regain the high ground with tech production. That's why, you know, the push to make silicone chips here in the United States. Part of the problem is we know that China is going to take over Taiwan, and 90% of our sophisticated computer chips are made in Taiwan. And when China takes over Taiwan, they will control the chip industry. So there's kind of feverish attempt to create our own competitor here so we can supply our own needs. But we're just a day late and a dollar short in that endeavor. But what all this gave rise to is a new kind of money management, what we call multinational investment and asset management companies. And the names are familiar to many of you. BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, they began to dominate the financial markets. They, in many very sense, became bigger than the banks and really began to control through their use and transfer of investment funds bigger than the banks themselves. I mean, today, BlackRock is the world's largest asset manager with $8.6 trillion in assets under their management. They operate globally with 70 offices in 30 countries and have clients in over 100 countries. That's half the countries of the world. And when you put them together with the Vanguard Group and State Street, they're called the Big Three Index Fund Managers. They control $15 trillion in investments. They currently hold 5% of the investments in 97% of the Standard & Poor's 500 companies, equal to 3/4 of the entire U.S. economy. I'm not talking about the U.S. the federal budget. I'm talking about the U.S. economy. They're equal to 3/4 of it. They become far bigger than most nations around the world. In fact, they're probably the second largest asset controller in the world, second only to the United States. And it should be notable that they are heavily invested in China. So they have a very strong vested interest in maintaining good relationship with China. And at the end of the day, if China takes over Taiwan, it's not going to affect them one way or another. Let me illustrate it this way. Talking to one of our missionaries we support in Siberia, and he was saying that the sanctions haven't limited the ability for Russians to buy anything. It just cost them about 10% more. And essentially, he said what they do is they go to these Turkish businesses. Actually, their offices are right across the hallway from each other in Turkey and Istanbul. And the Russian executive goes into the Turkish executive's office. He places an order for them. Turkey buys the product, and then he receives and turns over ownership of that product to the Russian, who has paid him in Russian rubles. And then they turn around and simply order the product. The product is transferred from Turkey's dock, and when they get there, the Turks move it over to the Russians' dock, and the Russians put it on planes and send it over to Siberia or to Russia. So he said that even though I can still get my steel chainsaw or my parts for my steel chainsaw, they just cost me 10% more, but I can still get them. And so, essentially, the Russian economy has flourished under sanctions, particularly because they're trading with a number of countries directly, not using dollars anymore. And actually, the ruble has gone up in value as the dollar has gone down in value. So, essentially, they're okay if the average American standard of living becomes less and the poor of the world have more, although that's rarely what actually happens, because for them, essentially, they're involved in the transfer of money. They're not involved in the production and sale of products. So if something costs more, they just provide more money and then receive more money in exchange for the product which they bought. So these entities, and that's the biggest problem, is it doesn't affect them directly. And it's really part of what we're seeing in the United States, where the average person is getting poorer and these entities are getting richer because of what is this perverse dynamic of private and government enterprise. So that we find, for example, with Pfizer and the Fodemic that we just went through, President Trump's desire to produce a warp speed vaccine. I don't know if that was his idea or he was sold that to somebody, but it was just a really bad idea, probably the biggest mistake of his administration. But the thing is that what they did is the government provided the funds to develop the vaccine and then allowed the manufacturer, Pfizer and others, to sell the vaccine, but the government paid for the purchase. So we paid for the development, we paid for the purchase. That's why they were getting free vaccines, and Pfizer has these streams of income which led them to unbelievably huge profits. And it was supposed to be this partnership. All they did is produce the product. They didn't pay for it. They didn't invest in its development. And they profited from its sale by guarantees. And then they were inured from any obligation or responsibility for producing something that has caused a lot of harm to a lot of people and was essentially ineffective in stopping the epidemic. In fact, may have contributed to its spread, in my opinion. But anyway, it was the UN, getting back to our friends of the UN, who were led by a number of lesser countries who often find themselves suffering most because of U.S. economic hegemony or control. They hatched a plan to bring equity into the system and get rid of inequity. And remember, the word equity is literally kind of a loaded term because it's used instead of equality. Equality refers to equal opportunity, a level playing field. Equity refers to equal outcome, that no matter how hard you work, we all get the same paycheck. And when the Russians did that, and the Chinese did that, and others have done it, that has never well worked out well because it robs people of any kind of true hard work and initiative. Why work harder? I'm not going to get anything more for it. And so they came up with this idea of restructuring the world economy based on an equitable sharing of assets. In 1995, the United Nations launched what they called Agenda 2021. Now they've renamed it Agenda 2030 because they ran into some obstacles, apparently. But basically, if you take the time to Google Agenda 2021 or even Agenda 2030 online, you can read what it says. And I admit, it's long and boring and full of all sorts of legalese and strange terminology. But when you really kind of listen to it and think about what they say in it, it becomes a template for the socialist takeover of the world's assets. In other words, the World Economic Forum has been much more forthright in stating their goals, which line up with this agenda, and that there's no longer any private property, that there's a guaranteed basic income for everybody, there's a sharing of all natural resources as deemed equitable by these 10 ruling nations, and they'll bring an end to climate-harming activities, things like cars. They'll reduce pollution by turning everything electrical, which we aren't able to really sustain and will lead to all sorts of hardships and difficulties. We see it even in the European Union, which is bought in wholesale into this, because the European Union is also more an economic entity than it is a manufacturing entity. Really, the real harm of Brexit for them was the EU, basically London, was the center of European economic activity, and I think it's a matter of time before we'll see England rejoining the EU, because many of their other portions like Scotland and others and Ireland would like to go back into the European Union and eliminate the control that Britain has over them. But anyway, those are my thoughts. But they have this idea, for example, of 15-minute cities. And what's a 15-minute city? It's basically creating communities where everything you need is in a 15-minute walk from where you live. So you don't need a car. You don't need any kind of even public transportation. You can simply walk to wherever you need to go. And this is actually a plan that they're working to put into place. Now, the problem is you're not allowed to leave your 15-minute city. If you want to go across town, good luck getting there. You probably have to walk there, but there even could be the controls set in place where you're not allowed to step out of your area, because athlete, there will be a controlled distribution of products and assets, so that if you're going to another 15-minute city and buying their Kool-Aid, then you're keeping somebody in that city from being able to get their fair portion of it. And so this apportionment of assets is going to be part and parcel of this idea, because there's one thing that bureaucrats love, and that's what all of this has done, is run by technocrats. We used to call them bureaucrats, but they're technocrats. One thing they love is they love data, and they love data so they can control people. They don't see people, they see data points, and they run everything based upon data points with a profit-loss dynamic. We can afford so much loss. There's so much collateral damage that we can sustain as long as it keeps the operation going. So what becomes the change is the individual no longer is valuable. The individual is no longer sovereign. The individual becomes part of the collective. That's what socialism does. And that's what communism does, and that's what fascism does. The individual is no longer important. Conforming to the collective is important. So with the help of presidents like Clinton and Obama, and now on steroids, Biden, which many of us believe is the third Obama administration, there has been a consistent effort to diminish the role of the United States in world affairs. And they do it not by the ballot box, which they, I believe, stuff to put in their preferred candidates. You can't tell me that Joe Biden was the largest drawing politician in votes in the history of the world, not just the United States, that Trump, who got more votes than any other candidate in the history of the United States, except for Joe Biden, who beat him by 5 million votes. I mean, please, it beggars credibility. Anyway, but they did this to take control of the U.S. economy. And although this effort has been going on, as I pointed out, for many years, COVID became the prime catalyst. By executive order and by terrifying people and making them incredibly compliant, they shut down the economy, they shut down society as a whole, so we couldn't even talk to each other. The media became compliant so that you couldn't even get honest information. Even, people like Fox News began to push the same narrative. Very few people, other than a couple people like, I would say, Tucker Carlson, even asked any questions. Yeah, what it did basically is create a system that was completely in step with the World Economic Forum. Now, the World Economic Forum is not part of the United Nations, but it walks in lockstep with it. And what it did is it provided a way of bypassing the politics and the organizing of the world elites to create a common one world government. They focused on getting to the real issues of global commerce, which is economic development, basically political concerns, important social issues, global warming, climate change, because global warming stopped happening in 2015 and global temperatures began to drop, so that now we find California is being flooded by the heaviest rainfall they have in their recorded history. But some of the world's most prominent business leaders, politicians, policymakers, scholars, philanthropists, trade unionists, representatives of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and which is in many ways just partnerships between business and government, attend the annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland every year. The WEF, the World Economic Forum, was founded by Klaus Schwab, a German scholar of business policy, and he was a professor at the University of Geneva. And in 1971, he organized a meeting of the European corporate leaders and helped them to find out how they could become more competitive against American companies. He has always had an underlying desire to see the U.S. economic machine weaken. So the group assumed the name of the World Economic Forum in 1987, right about in the same time frame, to reflect what they said were the importance of the global economic and political issues. They wanted to deal with poverty and environmental problems like climate change and international conflicts like with Cyprus and Greece and North and South Korea and so forth, even with apartheid in South Africa. And they began immediately to figure out ways to resolve it, even in trying to get people to stop buying products from Israel, whom they like to describe as an apartheid regime. and favoring the Palestinians for various odd reasons. There are hundreds of more millions Palestinians and Arabs in the world, in the Middle East, than there are Jews in Israel. And so they really wanted to bring to an end the conflict between new nations. What I find is so curious about the World Economic Forum is their idea of a partnership between government and business, which is exactly what the Nazis did, the fascists did in Germany. Most people don't realize that Germany, the Nazis, didn't take over industry. What they did was they allowed private ownership to continue, but they were forced to follow the agenda of the government. And so what we find is we find IB Farben, one of these huge, still existent German corporations, who essentially ran the artificial rubber factories at Auschwitz. They got their laborers from Auschwitz. And the lifespan of most of the people who worked in the factories run by IB Farben were about 4 months. In 4 months, they would work them to death because they were cheap labor. You didn't have to feed them, and there were always thousands and thousands of new laborers coming in. And so these companies became very rich and very wealthy and were spared accountability after the war because we wanted to see their economic viability continue and see Eastern Europe regain its place on the world stage, and so that we could help oppose the Soviet Union. But we have to understand that guys like Klaus Schwab, who is a German and was growing up during this period of Nazi power, probably got some of his ideas. I can't prove that. That's my suspicion. But anyway, admittedly, as I'm telling you these things, and this may surprise you, I'm really oversimplifying it. But essentially what it created was a completely new environment of global connectedness and global concerns, that the real power and influence shifted from the United Nations to the United States and now is shifted over to the World Economic Forum, who again seeks to work in partnership with the United Nations and in close partnership with the current administration. Particularly, we find with Trudeau in Canada, who half of his cabinet are members of the World Economic Forum, walks in lockstep. I believe personally the guy's candidating to be the next leader of the World Economic Forum, but that's just my suspicion by his obvious actions. But these global elites became kind of a boys' club of these elites, because they were rich, they were powerful, they were famous, they were influential, and they began to think beyond nations. The United States to them was just a blip in the historical landmark, and they began to formulate ways of how can we end these conflicts in the world? How can we end poverty? How can we bring to pass utopia on planet Earth using their wealth, their influence, to shape and move and promote global leaders? Simultaneously, the Chinese were raising their global influence by using the dollar to bribe U.S. influence politicians to support their drive to become the world rulers. And I find it fascinating because in Revelation, there are two great powers in the world during the time of the Antichrist. There's a global empire of the beast, the Antichrist, and there's also the kings of the Orient, Asia. And I'm thinking that really China becomes subservient to the global move for a season, but then they rise again to reassert their beliefs that this should be the Chinese century and they should rule supreme. But I am convinced that our current U.S. government is pretty much owned by the communist Chinese. And that's why we allow spy balloons to fly over our territory. It's why we never take any kind of action against Chinese incursions. In fact, even today, every import into our country is carefully examined, except those who come from China. We do not search Chinese imports into this country. They're off limits. And they're allowed to buy hundreds of thousands of acres of land around the United States. And our U.S. government does nothing to restrict them. The only time they take any action is when it becomes so publicly knowledgeable that it's embarrassing, and so they will do something. But it's not surprising that whether we're talking about Nancy Pelosi or Dianne Feinstein or Eric Swalwell or scores of these politicians, even Mitch McConnell, are highly invested in Chinese investment. And it's becoming clear from these legal actions and of the Congress and the little bit of action by the Justice Department to look at Hunter Biden, it's becoming apparent that our current president has been completely compromised by the Chinese and has been receiving money from them and other countries for decades. Well, it was at this point that the global corporations, especially global investment companies, who owe no loyalty to any country, became part of the process of globalization. For them, it's an economic decision. In 2005, the UN began promoting this thing called ESG. And ESG investing is part of the 2021-2030 agenda. And it stands for E as the environmental, which talks about things that affect the climate, the globe. Climate change is, you know, key in this diagnosis. And if you look under ESG, there's a whole list of different things that they want to control. The social part is really diversity, inclusion, and equity. The idea that basically we need to be inclusive. And this is where the whole LGBTQ, homosexual agenda, sort of thing fits into the conversation. And then there's the issue of governance, which initially meant corporate governance, but really it's the corporate governance being governed by these outside entities, but essentially they become the governance of these countries. And the plan really requires businesses to prove that before they can get investment money, they are compliant with these goals. And so if you want to expand or grow your business, then you have to show that you're living up to these requirements. And most of all of the major banks in the United States now are applying this principle to different companies that go to them to get investment funds. Now, you sit there saying, well, why would a big corporation which makes billions of dollars be concerned about investment funds? Because they pay those funds to their investors, to their stockholders. But if they want to expand and develop their corporations, they borrow money from investment companies, people like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street. And so as a result, in order for them to get these profits, they have to go to these entities in order to get these monies. Now, why would somebody like BlackRock buy into the ESG thing? Because it was Milton Friedman that said the principle of business is just simply to make profits, not to make social or moral judgments. And that was pretty much the guiding force behind most of our business operations for the previous 50 years. Well, there was a real value in it, because what it did is it brings the whole world in compliance with a socialistic UN plan, basically of one world government. And basically that one world government is going to be run by economic forces. That's why it says of the Antichrist, you can't buy or sell without receiving the mark. This focus or the foundation of the Antichrist global empire is an economic one. So one world economics is the goal, and it's also the most profitable one, because what it does is it increases the profit margins of places, people like BlackRock. I mean, in other words, in requiring companies to comply to these standards, many of them have to make huge financial investments in things that they haven't previously spent money on. What does that mean? They have to borrow more money. And when they borrow more money to fulfill these obligations, that means that they increase the amount of money they have to pay back at the interest rates that are required of them, and therefore it makes more money for BlackRock. So in the end of the day, it's always about money. The love of money is the root of all evil, and essentially it's that evil that drives people like BlackRock and Larry Fink, who runs that corporation, the same with Vanguard or with State Street. That's ultimately what drives them, is we just need to make more money. As long as we're making more money, we're increasing our power. We're increasing our role to guide the direction of the world. In the end of the day, all they care is to become more profitable. Well, this hasn't come without some kind of pushback. I mean, we find that ESJ in particular has been criticized by people from both sides of the table. I mean, there's a certain hypocrisy. They invest in companies that are involved in producing fossil fuels and the arms industry and human rights violation in China with, you know, say, for example, the Uyghurs or organ harvesting or the production of fentanyl to be sold on the streets of America and Europe. So to counter these criticisms as well, BlackRock has increased its pressure on banks and businesses not to invest in businesses that contribute to, in their opinion, climate change, gun violence, and they instead need to be really forthright in promoting gender equality and diversity. So when you're looking at Budweiser and you're saying, why in the world would you put this faux woman on the cover, this pretender on the cover, this guy who's posing as a woman on the cover of a beer can, what were you thinking? Well, certainly the advertising executives who promoted the idea and sold the ideas were doing it because they drunk the Kool-Aid and they believe all this diversity stuff and that America is bad and Christianity is evil. But the executives who wrote off on it, who will not be punished, they just fire those people, but who will not be punished, did it because, hey, this checks one of the boxes. This meets the requirement of gender diversity that we have to live up to in order to meet the ESG standards. And so what are some of these companies? Well, as we know Budweiser, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Johnson & Johnson, Exxon, Chase Manhattan, Visa, Chevron, Home Depot, Pfizer, MasterCard, Pepsi, Coke, Facebook, Bank of America, Walmart, Costco, McDonald's, Verizon, Disney, Raytheon, UPS, Nike, AT&T, Netflix, ZVS, pharmacies, Lockheed, Salesforce, Starbucks, Amex, Boeing, General Mills, and even Fox News. In fact, Fox News recently received $45 million investment from BlackRock. You just wonder, did that play a part in their decision to fire Tucker Carlson? I mean, he has been an active critic of the Ukrainian war, and he's focused a lot of attention on the threat the Chinese is to our way of life. And all of that is really bad for business if you're BlackRock. So if you put it all together, these companies together owe BlackRock some $7 billion that they're relying upon these investments in a major way. So if these entities go along with many major universities and thousands of other smaller businesses that are receiving behests from China and other businesses, if they want to grow their business, if they want to see new investment, they increasingly have to raise their credit score by modifying their ESG rating. They need to check more of those ESG boxes. And so they promote things that aren't smart, like electric vehicles. Why would car companies produce something that they know themselves would not be affordable and would not really be something that would benefit their customers? They do it to meet the requirements in the same way that it meets some of the fuel requirements being put on them by the federal government and by California. So if you have an electric vehicle, your overall consumption of fuel goes down so you can continue to sell the expensive Escalades that consume all sorts of fuel and not have to make any other major changes. It also, you know, affects their idea of diversity and equity and inclusion. So they hire people to make sure that they're meeting their standards and they're hiring enough people in these areas. And, of course, the people they hire are completely sold in on this agenda. But you have to go back to the people who actually pay the check, write the check. They don't give a rip. All they care about is raising the bottom line and making more money. And what it does is it increases their personal profile in the world. These individuals are sociopaths who are obsessed with power and control, and that's all that drives them. They want to be the most powerful person on the planet, and they know that politics is impossible, and so they're shooting for economic power and control. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. So at its heart, this is all about economics. It's all about profits. ESG is just another device to increase that power and profitability. And it does it in a way that reduces their own risk because they completely control the companies that they now fund. It is nothing else than one of the vehicles that is going to lead us to one world government and one world economy and one real world religion, which is a complicated one because religion is an issue of faith, but one of these days I'll tackle this issue of how is faith being transformed in our world to conform to support for this one world agenda. It's happening. It's very subtle, but it's happening, and a lot of people are drinking the Kool-Aid. So, wow, that's a lot of stuff. That's probably one of my longest. I hope it didn't fly by too fast, but I hope it made sense. And at least you'll understand when you see that BlackRock commercial who talks about how they're investing in the future and you realize that your pension fund is invested into BlackRock, they're trusting BlackRock to handle their monies and to make them grow, that you're actually unwittingly participating in the development of one world government and one world economy. So thanks for listening. God bless you and go in His grace.